First of all, just like to welcome everybody who came along tonight. I thought with the rains it might be a bit difficult, people might not come along, but actually the rain held off at the end there, and so a good crowd turned up this evening. I also wondered how many people would turn up, because the subject was the establishment of the four assemblies, and then I got a number of questions, actually, as to what the four assemblies were. People didn't know what they were, so they didn't know what the talk was going to be about. But the four assemblies are the really important category that the Buddha established, which is quite simply, actually, it's of the bhikkhus, or the monks, the bhikkhunis, the nuns, the upasakas, the laymen, and the upasikas, the lay women. Those are the people who make up the groups who are following the Buddha's teachings. The Buddha, as we all know, was really a great teacher of not only morals, but also for the complete path to liberation. And mainly when Dhamma talks are being given, they're given on the subjects of, you know, morality or meditation or good practices and so on. And really, as there's said to be 84,000 dhammas in the teaching, the amount of variations that you can give on those teachings is virtually endless. So the Buddha told one time that even if he was to start teaching the Satipatthanas and he was to continue teaching all day and all night and all the way through the year, even if 100 years went past, you wouldn't be able to get to the end of the teaching. That's because there's so much that can be elaborated from the teaching that has been passed down to us. But tonight I wanted to talk about something a little different and a little something that's not normally taken into consideration. Now, the Buddha himself told at one time, with certain sasanas, that certain dispensations that have been given by the Buddha, they didn't last very long. It's a bit surprising when you come across that, because we always think that, you know, the Buddha must set up the absolutely perfect situation and he gives the perfect teaching and then it must last for so long. But it depends quite considerably on how the teaching has been set up so that it can be passed on down through the ages. This is why the internal organization of the groups within the Buddhist fold is so important, and also how they relate to each other. That's also an important part of this whole area. So I wanted to discuss how the Buddha set up the sasana so that it would be able to survive for so long. Now, if you think about it, for me anyway, I'm always completely astonished that the Buddha gave the teaching 2,500 years ago in a small area, basically, in northeastern India, and that teaching has continued all the way down to our own period. But it's actually by no accident, but it was, of course, it's intended to last, but the Buddha put in place the organizations that would make it last. Now, this organization that he set up is the monks and the nuns and the lay people, the lay men and the lay women. Now, there's a very interesting thing in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. The Mahaparinibbana Sutta traces the last year of the Buddha's life. It's one of the few actual narratives that we have. This covers a period from about 1 year before the Buddha passed into Nibbana, and the journey that he made and the instructions that he was giving on that last journey. Now, the Buddha, as you might imagine, was concerned at the end that he should have everything organized correctly, in place correctly, so that the teaching that he had spent the last 45 years propagating, that teaching would be able to be passed down to the next generations. One thing that had happened, you see, is that the Jaina teachings had virtually fallen apart after the passing away of Mahavira, which had happened about a year before. So the Buddha would have seen that. You know, they were losing the teachings. It hadn't been properly established. If the teachings are not being set up properly and they're not being able to be passed on properly, of course, in an oral culture, it's very easy for it to break down. Now then, while he was on this journey, the Buddha actually made a decision that he would not carry on living. He made a decision to give up the will to life. And the information that is recorded there is quite interesting, actually, because it's said that Mara came to the Buddha, and Mara told, you know, that just after the enlightenment, just after the Buddha had been enlightened, that he had come to the Buddha and he had asked him to attain Nibbana at that point. I don't know if you know this, actually, but according to the traditional stories, after the Buddha attained awakening under the Bodhi tree, it's told that Mara actually followed the Buddha around for a year after that period, looking for an opening, looking to see if he could trip him up. So he tried to tempt him, and you know, there's this period in the when the Buddha has just attained awakening, there's this period where the Buddha is unsure whether he's going to teach or not. See, at that point, he could actually have just entered Nibbana and not gone on with the teaching. Not everybody who actually attains awakening does go on to make the teaching. But the Buddha told, this is a quotation now, he said, "For as long as my monks are not true disciples, accomplished and disciplined, confident, learned, bearers of the teaching, who are practicing in conformity with the teaching, correct in their practice, living in conformity with the teaching, and having learned it from their own teacher, will declare, reveal, make known, set forth, open up, analyze, make plain, after giving a good rebuke with reason to the doctrines of others that have arisen, and teach the miraculous teaching, he wouldn't attain Nibbana." That means that he intended that the monks would be properly trained, properly practiced, and able to teach and pass on the sasana, and he wouldn't attain parinibbana until that point. Now, this is the interesting thing, because, in fact, he also repeated that in regard to the bhikshunis, and he also repeated it in regard to the laymen, and in regard to the lay women as well. Now, there's two very interesting points here. The first one is that the Buddha really intended that not only the monks should be educated and should understand the Dhamma, should be well practiced in the Dhamma, not just the nuns, so it's not just the monastics, but all the people that he'd been teaching, including the lay people, should also be a really highly educated, well practiced community. And there's an interesting kind of corroborative evidence for the fact that the lay people and the monastics were at this standard by the time the Buddha attained parinibbana. At one time, the Buddha was in a small village called Nardika, and Ananda came to see the Buddha, and he asked about one of the devotees who had just passed away, and asked what was their destination. And the Buddha told that this particular lay person had attained to the state of non-returning, and that he would be born in the Brahma heavens, and that from there he would pass on to Nibbana without being reborn in this world again. And then Ananda asked about somebody else who had passed away, and the Buddha explained that person had attained the second path. And then he asked about a third person, and a fourth person, and a fifth person, and the Buddha said, look, this is getting a bit tiring, actually. And he said, even in this small village, the amount of people who have attained to the third path is about 500, and the amount of people who have attained to the second path is about 300, and the amount of people who have attained to the first path is, like 200 or something. Actually, I forget the numbers. But the important thing is that there were literally hundreds and hundreds of people, not only monks and nuns, but also lay people who had attained the paths and fruitions, and were able to teach as well. There are records of lay people who were teaching in those days who were declared to be great teachers by the Buddha. So the Buddha set up these four communities, and I want to discuss a little bit about how they were structured. Now, with the Sangha, it was set up in such a way that all the communities were small communities where the monks would come together as equals. Of course, there are senior monks and so on and so forth, but nevertheless, everybody would be in an equal position, and they would come together in the communities every couple of weeks so that everybody would know each other and everybody would be in communion with each other. It's one of the characteristics of the early Sangha that it was very united. There were many monasteries, even in Lord Buddha's times, with thousands of monks living in them around, like the big cities like Sarvati and Rajagaha, which were capital cities in those days. But it was expected that they would come together, you know, at least once a fortnight. Everybody would come together and then they would recite the rules, they would recite the Patimokkha, and everybody would know each other, you see. One of the other characteristics of the early Sangha is that they were living according to the rules that had been laid down by the Buddha. In fact, during this last journey of the Buddha, he also talked about how the Sangha will continue well into the future. What are the conditions that need to be fulfilled for the Sangha to continue into the future? He gave seven conditions for the prosperity of the Sangha, which is, the first one is that they should all assemble regularly. They should come to unanimous decisions. They should maintain the old laws and not establish any new laws. That means the laws that had been laid down by the Buddha, those laws to continue, and other ones not to be introduced. This will become important later when we look at the present situation. And then they should honour the elder monks and not come under the influence of craving. They should desire to live in forest dwellings and attend to the ways of mindfulness. Now, the thing that impresses me about this is that there were really a couple of different types of models for the organisation of societies in those days. At that time, there were actually two different kind of organizations. One was a hierarchical, monarchical system, which was just arising at that time and being very successful in India. And the other were more like what we would call nowadays face-to-face democracies, where certain elders would come together and then they would have what we would say in English a meet. It's an old word. It's like a parliament where all the people would come together who were concerned, and then they would be in discussion in face-to-face democracy. And they would be living according to the laws that had been passed down to them through the generations. Now, the Buddha himself came from that sort of society, not a monarchical society, but a face-to-face democratic society. The Sakyas were a republic. And when he set up the Sangha, he set it up according to that model. You'll remember the very famous saying, which is also given, you see, in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, towards the end of the Buddha's life, that people should live according to their own light and live according to the Dhamma. They were not to rely on a new teacher arising. That means nobody was going to be appointed to be head of the Sangha after the Buddha had passed away. He was actually questioned about this. Who will lead the Sangha when after Lord Buddha had passed away? And he said, nobody will lead the Sangha. They will live according to the Dhamma and the Vinaya that I have preached. And so now these groups, you can describe them as autonomous. They're able to act and make decisions in their own sphere according to the laws that had been given to them. They were united. They would all come together. They were non-hierarchical, and they were like face-to-face democracies. That's the organization of the Sangha that was intended by the Buddha. Now, that applied, of course, both to the bhikkhus and to the bhikkhunis, because they were both part of the Sangha. Now, I just want to talk about something to do with women's position in ancient India. There's just actually been a survey done by the UN, if I remember correctly, looking at what is the worst place in the world to be born a woman. According to this survey, I'm not sure how they work it out, actually. It doesn't really matter because the point will come across anyway. But according to this survey, the worst place to be born a woman at the present time is in Afghanistan. There's some actually really terrible statistics, you know. It's all this sort of thing, but I always get my statistics wrong. But it's all this sort of thing like, you know, only 10% of the women are literate. I don't know if you know, actually, but some of the schools in Afghanistan, if there are girls going to those schools, people will actually go in and throw bombs in the schools. There's been several attacks on girls' schools in northern Afghanistan. You don't see it in these big headlines, but in actual fact, these things are going on. You know, just girls going to school, and they're attacked and murdered for it. Also, another terrible statistic is about 1 in 12 women die in childbirth in Afghanistan. That means getting pregnant is a really, really dangerous thing, you know, if you're living in Afghanistan, because you may not have any medical facilities at all. You may not be able to go to a hospital. You know, you might not be let out of the home. You might have to have that child in the home, and you may not survive it. So that's the worst place, apparently, you know, according to the way that they've worked this out. The worst place to be is to be born in Afghanistan. The second worst place is to be born in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Third worst place is Pakistan. And the fourth worst place is India. Now, this is very interesting because in ancient India, actually, women were not in this position at all, but actually had quite a good position. Even in the Brahminical tradition, which eventually became very patriarchal and very male-dominated, in the early teachings, you often find women teachers. And again, with the other Shramana sects, that means the other ascetic sects, the Buddhists were part of the ascetic movement. So with the other ascetic sects like the Jainas and the Wanderers, the Paribhajikas, with these groups also, women were able to go forth. Also with the lay women, were expected to look after the finances of the household. That means they actually had all the finance. The men, of course, would have their own sphere. They would be, you know, merchants or whatever it is like this, but so they would be the householder, but the wife would also have regular authority over many people within the household and also over all the finances within the household. Now, in later times, we also see that lay women had a lot of disposable income. They were putting up temples. We have inscriptions, you know, where lay women have put up temples, and they've hired sculptors, and they've provided large-scale dhanas, and so on and so forth. So the position of women was actually quite reasonable, we could say, in ancient India. But the Buddha was the first one who, when questioned, said that women could also attain what is really the complete fulfillment of the human life, which is to attain Nibbana. So this took it actually a step further than anybody else had come, because it puts it in a complete position of equality. Everybody, male or female, low caste, high caste, rich, poor, even lepers, just trying to think of other groups, so many different groups who heard the teaching and were able to comprehend it also were able to attain Nibbana. There was a complete breakthrough in the teaching that was being given at that time. Now, as you know, there are recordings of the verses that were spoken when the monks attained awakening. Those have been recorded and we pass them down in the canon. What it means is that it was traditional at that time that when somebody had attained awakening, that they would express their joy in verse. They would speak a verse declaring that they had attained awakening. So there is a similar collection of verses also attributed to the bhikshunis. You know, some of the bhikshunis were really highly educated women, and some of the poetry that they wrote is really some of the best poetry we have from ancient India. And unfortunately, you know, those scriptures were included in the canon and were passed down. It's the only recordings actually that we have of that sort from such an early period of women talking about how they had attained enlightenment. We don't get that for a long, long period afterwards. Now, the bhikkhunis also played a very active part in passing down the teachings over the centuries after the Buddha passed away. One of the most important things is from, you know, I'm ordained in Sri Lanka and come from that background. I spent a long time there, 15 years there, so I understand their point of view. And they have two real heroes, kind of local heroes, if you like, in their culture. One is Mahinda. Mahinda was the monk who first brought the Buddha's teaching to Sri Lanka and established it in the country. So, you know, you can imagine, you know, this is their religion for the last 2,200 years, and this is the founder for them. You know, without Mahinda, they wouldn't have their whole heritage. So he's held in really high regard. But when Mahinda came and taught, he taught initially to the king in the capital city, and also, of course, the queen and the ladies-in-waiting also heard this teaching. And so they aspired for ordination. That means the ladies who had heard the teaching and they wanted to go forth. So Mahinda sent back to India to ask for his sister, Sangamitta, to come to Sri Lanka and also to bring a branch of the Bodhi tree under which the Lord Buddha had attained awakening. And it's through Venerable Sangamitta that the Bhikshuni Sangha was established in Sri Lanka. According to the numbers that are given in the reports that we get, about 500 women went forth at the time, and that established the Bhikshuni Sangha in Sri Lanka. Now, there are several chronicles, as you might know, going back to very ancient times coming from Sri Lanka. The very earliest of those is called Dipawamsa. It means the story of the island. This is, telling the story from mythological times, from the foundation when the Sinhalese nation really was established in Sri Lanka. It's mythological, really, coming through into historical times with the arrival of Mahinda, and then up until about the 5th century AD. So it's like about a 1,000-year period. Now, it's generally agreed that the Dipawamsa was actually written by Bhikshunis. It was not written by the monks. Later, the monks also wrote chronicles based on the early chronicles, but it appears that the Dipawamsa was written by Bhikshunis. And in fact, for that reason, it becomes like a very important historical record, because those records form the basis upon which the later records were also written. Now, during that period also, we have records about Sri Lankan Bhikshunis going to China. It must have been quite a difficult journey, you know. It's not, in these days, of course, we just jump on Air Asia, you know, and it's quite easy to go. But in those days, you had to get into a ship, and maybe the ship made it, and maybe the ship didn't make it. So you had to have a good reason if you were going. Mainly, people were going. It was kind of like a gamble. They would take, you know, they were traders and they were taking goods across the seas, and then when they got them across the seas, they would make a fortune. But when the Bhikshunis went, of course, it's not to make a fortune by selling goods. They actually went because they were requested to pass on the Bhikshuni lineage in China. Up until that time, there had been some Bhikshunis ordained in China for about 100 years, but they had only been ordained by a single sangha. But the proper method, as long as there's a Bhikshuni sangha existing, just like they had to send for Sangamitta from India to come down to be able to pass on the Bhikshuni lineage, so in China they passed on the Bhikshuni lineage by bringing Bhikshunis from Sri Lanka, and then together with the monks in two separate ceremonies, they established the Bhikshuni Sangha. Now this becomes important later, that the Chinese, at least one lineage comes from, one lineage of the Bhikshunis comes from Sri Lanka. Now then, I just want to come right up to date. And what we see now, I've been talking about how the Sanghas were united, how they were like face-to-face democracies, and how there were four assemblies. And now when we look at the situation, we find out the Sangha is completely fragmented. Yeah, there are three main groups, but there's dozens or scores of different groups of Sangha. And it's very hierarchically organized, and there's only three assemblies, with a putative fourth assembly, as in the Theravada anyway. You may not know, actually, but people think that there are arguments about, you know, some bhikkhus accept the Bhikshuni order that has been re-established and some don't, okay? There's arguments about this. One section of the Sangha accepts it. It's quite well accepted in Sri Lanka, and one section of the Sangha doesn't accept it. What people don't realize is exactly the same situation occurs within the Bhikshu Sangha. That means there are some monks who accept that their compatriots are monks, and then they think the other monks are not monks. Like an obvious division that everybody will be aware of here is the division between the Theravadins and the Mahayanists. To a large extent, the Theravadins will not accept that the Mahayanists have been properly ordained, and they do not accept them as monks. But this also occurs within the Theravada as well. There are groups within the Theravada that don't accept other Theravadin monks as monks. So what we see is we've got a very, very divided Sangha, and it's very hierarchical, and the Bhikshuni Sangha, for the most part, is missing. That means at least in the Theravada and in the Tibetan traditions. So I just want to say shortly about how this has come about. In around the 10th and the 11th century, there were many wars in South India that were also spilling over into Sri Lanka. That means that people were coming from South India and they were attacking the Sinhalese who were in the north of the island. Monasteries were destroyed, monks were disrobed, books were burned, and quite a lot of deep destruction was actually made during that time. Now, over a period of time, both the Bhikshu Sanghas and the Bhikshuni Sanghas came to an end in Sri Lanka. About two times or three times, I forget, in Sri Lanka, the Bhikshu Sangha came to an end. The difference with it has been that when the Bhikshu Sangha came to an end, they actually went to Thailand or they went to Burma and they brought it back again. But when the Bhikshuni Sangha died out, at that time, it seems, for reasons that we don't know, I mean, there's no historical record of why something doesn't happen, there's only records of why things do happen, but for reasons we don't know, but when the Bhikshuni Sangha was passed out, even though it had been passed on to other countries, it was not brought back again. So effectively, the Bhikshuni Sangha in the Theravada passed out of existence about 1,000 years ago. We don't know exactly, about 1,000 years ago, probably around the 11th century. At the same time, actually, some other very disastrous things happened. For instance, we used to have the commentaries, which were being passed down in Sinhalese language. We had those commentaries up until about the same period. That means that there were two sets of commentaries, one in Sinhalese and one in Pali. Almost certainly what has happened is that when there were invasions, you see, the monks had to pick up the books that they could carry and take them further inland where they could be preserved. And they probably made a decision, because the Pali text by then had an authority that the Sinhalese text didn't have. They probably made a decision that they would take what was most important and leave behind what was not important or not so important, and all those scriptures got destroyed. Anyway, that's one aspect of it. That was how the Bhikshuni Sangha came to an end in the Theravada tradition. The second part is about it being hierarchical. Now then, during these invasions, there was one of the problems that they were facing is that the Sinhalese were broken up into little groups around the island. there would be a small king here and a small king there and a small king here, and they were not able to unite and fight off the invaders. Now one king arose who managed to unite all of the groups, all of the Singhalese groups, and they managed to push back the invaders out of the country, and they managed to re-establish not only their kingdom, you see, but their religion and everything, you know, their culture, everything that goes along with it. So it's a very important thing as far as they're concerned. It was the maintenance and passing down into the future of their kingdom and all their traditions that go with it, their culture and so on. That was so successful. That organization under one king was so successful that that king decided to reorganize the Sangha. And he reorganized it under exactly the same model that had been successful against the invaders. That's when you first get the Sangharaja arising. Now we have Sangharajas, you know, in all the countries. They're called different things in different places. In fact, in the original, it was called Mahasami. It means like great lord, the great lord over the Sangha. That's how the Sangha comes to be, even till today, hierarchically organized under, you know, a king of the Sangha, together with a council of elders who are able to dictate to the rest of the Sangha what is right and what is wrong and so on. Now the third thing that needs to be explained is how come everything is so fragmented. I think one of the main things is that from the center where the religion had been established with the missions from Ashoka, some went north with some with different traditions, some came south with different traditions, and eventually the center was destroyed. It means with the invasions of the Muslims in the 10th, 11th, 12th centuries, it basically Buddhism was destroyed in India, and all you had were these separated groups who were separated quite widely geographically, and without that center, you know, holding it together, then the traditions developed in different ways. In fact, there was already some differences because of the arising of new teachings about 500 years after the Buddha had passed away. I think most people don't understand those teachings, the Mahayana teachings, originally arose in South India, and one of their strongholds was in Sri Lanka. For those of you who know some of the Mahayana scriptures, you'll remember there's a scripture called, one of the main scriptures and one of the most important Mahayana scriptures is called Lankavatara, the entry into Sri Lanka. Tantric practices were also quite strong in Sri Lanka, as well as the Mahayana practices. We have records, for instance, of a Sri Lankan nun going to Tibet and learning the Tibetan language and actually becoming a translator from Sanskrit into Tibetan. There's also fairly good records of monastics going out from Sri Lanka to Java, which was also a big center for the tantric traditions in the Middle Ages. And as we saw earlier, we saw the Bhikshunis going to China and establishing there the Bhikshuni order. Anyway, to get back to the fragmentation of the Sangha, even within the Theravada, where it's fragmented, what happened was, in the 18th century, when again, under the pressure of the colonial powers, with the Portuguese, who were very violent in Sri Lanka, the Sangha come to such a state that there were no bhikkhus left in Sri Lanka. And so one group of novices actually went to Thailand, and there they managed to obtain higher ordination, sufficient number of them, and also some of the Thai monks came back to Sri Lanka, and then they were able to re-establish the Sangha again. So that started an individual lineage coming back from Thailand. Most of the monks that you see from Sri Lanka in Malaysia are actually from that tradition. But they had a kind of rule that they set up, which is completely against the original teaching, which was that they made it a caste-based lineage. That means That means only people from the high castes in Sri Lanka were able to ordain as monks. It's completely against the whole ethos of Buddhism, completely against the whole idea. If you look at the background where, you know, the Buddha started and everybody was able to come into the sanghas and everything like this, and it was like a big breakthrough. And then later when they re-established the sangha in Sri Lanka, they made it caste-based. So as you might imagine, many people were not very happy with this. For one thing, they couldn't get ordination if they were not in that caste. So that group of people went to Burma. The first group went to Ramanya, which is the Mon country. If you understand the differences in Myanmar, there are more than one group of people. So that was the Mons. Anyway, that set up a second lineage, you see. And then other people were not satisfied with either of those two groups. They went to what was actually Burma. It means Amarapura, which was the capital of Burma at that time. It's around where Mandalay is now. Okay, so that brought back a third lineage, you see. Now, these lineages will not have anything, more or less, you can say they don't have anything to do with each other. If you're in the Siam sect, I'm in Amarapura, okay? I can't go in a Siam sect Sima. The Siam sect ordained monks cannot come in our Sima. Okay? The Amarapura monks can't go in the Ramanya Sima. It's fragmented in a way that it was never intended, you see. So now, when we look at what was the Buddha's original intention when he set up the four assemblies, and we look at the state of Buddhism now, we see that it's almost a mirror image of what was intended. That means there were supposed to be four assemblies, and now in quite a large section of the Buddhist fold, there's only three. It was all supposed to be united, and it was supposed to be very low-level, face-to-face, democratic. And instead, what we see is there's only three assemblies, and they're completely fragmented, and it's very hierarchical. And all these problems are actually related together, you know. Now then, as many of you will know, there's been attempts over the last 15 years to re-establish the Bhikshuni order in the Theravada, which has been fairly successful, I would say. Of course, it's not completely successful because of all the divisions, but it's been fairly successful. In Sri Lanka now, there are about 1,000 Bhikshunis. There are many small groups around the world, in America, in Europe, also in Thailand, also in Australia, and there are various individuals as well who have managed to take Bhikshuni ordination. And the way that they managed to re-establish it, as some of you will know, the way that they managed to re-establish it is that they went to Taiwan. In fact, first they went to Korea and they did some ordinations in Korea. It was only a small number. But later, I think in 1998, through the lineage that had been passed through China, that had come through Sri Lanka, with the same group of nuns in that lineage, they passed it back to the Sri Lankan nuns. I think there's a very good moral in this. If you've got something worth having, you should give it to other people. If you give it to other people and you lose it yourself, they're able to give it you back. So it's a good argument for generosity played out over a long period of time, you see. Those nuns who went to China really put their lives at risk to try to take the Bhikshuni order to China. And later they were able to get that lineage back into Sri Lanka. Now the other good thing that I like about it myself is that it's Mahayana nuns helping Theravada nuns. That means these two big divides that we see in the Buddhist world actually coming together to help each other. I think it can be really a model for how we can go forward from here, and how we, you know, make some sort of efforts to get back to what the Buddha originally intended when he set up the four assemblies. One of the main obstructions, as you will know, to the establishment of the re-establishment of Bhikshuni Sangha has been from the hierarchy. Mainly if you talk to lay people, most lay people, perhaps not everybody, but most lay people are in favour of the re-establishment of the Bhikshuni Sangha. Most monks that I've met as well, either in favour of the re-establishment of the Bhikshuni order, or they're not opposed to it. But in many cases, the hierarchy in the Sangha are opposed to it. Many of you will know about the situation with Ajahn Brahm that happened a couple of years ago, because it was such a big issue for some reason. And he, you know, he helped some nuns take higher ordination. Sometimes you might hear that he gave the higher ordination. He cannot give the higher ordination. The higher ordination comes from the bhikshunis, not from the monks. The monks only confirm it. And because of that, he was summoned to go to meet with the hierarchy in, it means the Sangha Council in Thailand, and explain himself. And eventually, he was delisted. sounds quite terrible, actually, isn't it? He was delisted from the Ajahn Chah group of monasteries. That means he was thrown out of that Sangha, if you like, out of that sect, and the monastery that he's in charge of was delisted. That means it's no longer counted as an Ajahn Chah lineage monastery. And one of the main reasons for that is because he comes under Thai Sangha law, and they were invoking a 1930 Thai Sangha law that was passed, which made it illegal for nuns to take higher ordination. Believe it or not, it's actually a civil law offence in Thailand for a woman to take higher ordination. They can be prosecuted with impersonation of a monk. Now, you'll remember when I was talking earlier and saying how the Buddha had established the Sangha, and he said that they should maintain the old laws and not establish new laws. So this is obviously a new law that was not intended by the Buddha, that should be able to apply to the monks and the nuns. In fact, we're structured and we're governed by the rules that were given by the Buddha, not the rules that were given in a civil society in the 20th century. So I think you can see that, you know, this is the situation that we face at the moment. I think myself it will change, you know. It will change just by the sheer force of people doing what is right. And just as laws have been introduced, as we all know, laws can be abrogated as well. And just as hierarchies can be established, hierarchies can be de-established. And just as orders can go out of existence, with some fortune, they can be brought back into existence. I think if that happened, then, in fact, that means if we manage to re-establish in a really strong way, really manage to re-establish the Bhikkhuni order, it would be such a big boost for Theravada Buddhism in many ways. Just in terms of numbers, for instance, I was really astonished. But, you know, I've got a good friend in Bante Saranankara in KL, who's a Sri Lankan monk, who's one of the leading monks in Malaysia. And he was telling me that at the moment in Sri Lanka, the members of the Sangha, that means the Bhikshu Sangha, has dropped from 30,000 to 15,000 in the last 5 years. Meanwhile, there are like over 2,000 temples just standing empty. Now then, one of the things is, with the re-establishment of the Bhikshuni order, the Bhikshunis are able to replace the monks who are no longer ordaining. So just on the kind of very, you know, low level of numbers, just on this, you know, problem of numbers, because this trend is happening in all the countries. I'm not sure about Burma, because it's still kind of trapped in this kind of trapped in aspect because of the underdevelopment in Burma. But in Thailand, all the numbers at the Bhikkhu Sangha is also going down. So just in a gross way, which I would consider this, just a gross way of, you know, to do with numbers of people, you know, as we're getting many nuns ordaining and fewer monks ordaining, you know, that is replacing the loss in the Bhikshu Sangha. It's only a quantitative thing. Qualitatively, there is a big difference, I think, because there are certain activities, I feel, that women are more inclined to than men are inclined to. So we see with the re-establishment of the Bhikshuni Sangha in Sri Lanka that they're engaged in certain activities that the monks have not been engaged in. It means things like healthcare programs, educational programs, outreach to the poor and the sick in the communities, counseling for women. And like, as a monk, I can tell you many times we get men come to us and they talk about the problem they have with women. And then we, you know, we counsel them and we comfort them and we hold their hand and we tell them, well, you know, they're not all so bad. But, you know, it's very rare that we get women come to us and tell, you know, and try, ask for counseling from their side of things. Because of course, it's awkward to go to a man and tell them that, you know, they got problems with their men. So one of the things that is happening in Sri Lanka is that the women now have a place to go and somewhere where they can go and get spiritual counseling over the problems that they face in their everyday life. And then, you know, the nuns tell them, well, you know, they hold their hands and they comfort them and they tell them, well, all the men are not so bad. But anyway, this is, you know, one part of it, that women monastics can provide counseling for lay women that, you know, the monks are not able to do. Another aspect of it is that there have been, you know, things like orphanages have been set up, because women naturally incline, even if they're monastic, they naturally incline to look after children. You know, whereas the monks don't do that. You know, you don't see many orphanages run by monks. Even if they're set up by monks, they're not run by monks. Also, you know, this also comes into it like healthcare outreach programs into the community. You just imagine the difference it would make in Afghanistan if there were nuns there and they were able to go out into the communities and teach even basic healthcare in these, you know, the communities that don't have access to this information. But besides that, the nuns are also taking part in all the normal activities that you see the monks taking part. So many of them are giving meditation classes. They give Dhamma talks, of course. In fact, later in this year, we should have a Bhikshuni coming from Ajahn Brahm's monastery in Perth, and she will be giving a Dhamma talk here. She's now actually the head of the Bhikshuni house in Perth. She's Malaysian, actually, from Ipoh. There were four women who took a higher ordination at that Ajahn Brahm ordination in Perth at that time. Two were Malaysian. One, I think, is Singaporean, and the other was Australian. I think it's like that. And actually, the week after the Bhikshuni comes, then Ajahn Brahm himself will be coming as well. And he will take part in our Mahasangika Dana on Christmas Day, and we'll be giving the Dhamma talk there. Okay, so these anyway are some of the advantages I could see in the re-establishment. It would just bring a balance back to the assemblies. It would re-establish to a large extent what the Buddha had originally intended when he set up the sasana, you know, so long ago, and which over the years, for various reasons, not all of which were bad, you know, it's some of it is accidents, some of it is just like the kind of ups and downs of history or something like that, okay? We can appreciate that it's not all just ill will or anything like that. There are reasons why these things have changed, but they've changed so they're to the position where they're almost upside down. And now what we want to do, trying to go forward, is to break down these barriers between the sanghas, so the sanghas are back in communion with each other, re-establish the Bhikshuni Sangha so that we have a more balanced communities, and also break down the hierarchies so these hierarchies cannot maintain structures that were never intended to be there in the first place. Okay, I have to be a little careful about what I say, else I'm going to be excommunicated or something. But it's not that I feel that anybody's got ill will in this, you know. It's not that I'm blaming the senior monks or anything like that. All the monks have great respect for the senior monks. But we also have to look and see what the Buddha intended. Having faith in the Buddha's teaching, having faith in the structures that he set up, trying to, you know, set it up so that the sasana can not only continue into the future but can flourish and can really become a strong and vibrant force in the future. We've got to get some unity together. That's one thing. We've got to get the balance back into the Sangha. That's another thing. And we've got to have structures that were intended by the Buddha so that the whole thing can continue and become like a really strong force, because it's not a strong force at present. Yeah. There's not a strong Buddhist voice at present. And one of the reasons is it's so completely disunited. In fact, all the Buddhist groups, if we look at the main groups, we can say the Mahayana, the Theravada, the Tibetan, they all take the Buddha as their teacher. They all accept the most basic teachings, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Noble Path. They all trace their lineage right the way back to the Buddha. And the same thing applies to, you know, like the arguments between, let's say, the Mahasi groups and the Powout groups, or the Powout groups and the Ajahn Chah groups, or whatever, you know, all these different groups. They all actually support the Buddha is our teacher, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Noble Path. All the other kind of basic teachings are accepted by everybody. So if we can take a broader view of what the real situation is in Buddhism, trying to get back to a united fold, I think we'd find that we would have a much stronger voice in the world, and we'd be able to give guidance even outside of the Buddhist fold. You know yourselves that in the West, there's a, you know, all the practices that are being taught in Buddhism, you know, are being also taught now in schools, in healthcare places, and so on and so forth. They're not taught as Buddhism. They're just taught as good practices. So it's okay. What we want to do, actually, is improve the situation in the world, make good states of mind arise, you know, and bad states of mind diminish. It doesn't matter that they call themselves Buddhist. That's not of real any interest. What is of interest is that the people in the world live more wholesome lives and get, you know, better states of mind. You know, in the end, they'll get better rebirths. In the end, they'll come into contact with the Dhamma. We don't need to worry about the Kamma end of it. As if we can have that influence, it's going to be for the best. So for all these good aspirations, for the progress of the sasana in the world, for the reunification of the Sangha, for the influence that the sasana can have for the good of the world, everybody say sadhu.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Okay, so I think it's good because it's not a normal subject. So if people want to ask questions, they'll be able to ask questions, all right? In fact, this is a problem. Even, you know, when the Sri Lankan bhikshunis went to China, I told that there were other bhikshunis who had been ordained only in the Bhikkhu Sangha. So now, with the re-establishment of the bhikshuni order, these bhikshunis, the original bhikshunis, were in a position where they were not sure about their ordination. Okay. And the ones that were sure about their ordination, right, were senior to the ones who were not, you see. So it does actually, it actually is like a real problem. It, you know, for instance, we have one Sayale who comes here. She's about 30 years ordained, and she's a teacher. She's quite well known, and she's very competent and everything like that. And then suddenly she finds that she's junior to a bhikshuni who's only 1 year ordained. So we should recognize that there are problems involved, and we have to acknowledge that and try to work it out, you know. It's also happening in Sri Lanka, because there are dasa sealers. That means, like you might know as Maichis or as Sayales, there are dasa sealers in Sri Lanka who have ordained 30, 40 years. And now suddenly a bhikshuni is ordained for 1 year, and they're senior to the That's a sealer, you see. So we shouldn't think that these are not problems. These are actually real live existential problems for people, you know, and they have to work it out. But in the end, we have to find a way to make it work. If it works for a generation, once you get over a generation, then it will, you know, that problem will be superseded by the reality of the situation. Recently, this year it means, we've been setting up a support network for nuns in Malaysia, actually in Malaysia and Singapore, like this. And one of the things we had to take into consideration is this actual problem. So we've actually called it Support Network for Women Renunciants in Malaysia and Singapore, because we don't want to exclude nuns who have been good nuns and very able and useful in the communities and everything over the previous years. The intention, of course, in setting up this network is to create the conditions whereby nuns feel confident enough to be able to become bhikshunis. But for those who don't want to become bhikshunis, then I think we have to provide, you know, the support that they need and try to work it out so that all. The point about this is, actually, most people won't know, but the nuns get virtually no support, whereas the monks will get support. The nuns get virtually no support except from their families. So anyway, if anybody's got any questions about it, it's quite a long and complex matter that I've tried to present tonight. What I was trying to do is, you know, show what the Buddha intended, show what the history was in between time, and the position we're at now, and how we can take it forward. You know, but that involves quite a lot of, you know, information that people probably not very much aware of or anything. So there's quite a lot gone over. So if anybody wants to ask any questions about that, then you can do so now. Basically because they introduced new laws which were not there in the first place. In about 1930, they introduced a law, which is still current in Thailand, whereby anybody who ordains as a bhikshuni, it's a civil offence whereby they can be arrested and accused of impersonating a monk. And they're not willing to give, they're not willing to simply, you know, there's an inertia. There's an inertia in any situation, any established situation. Yeah, that's normal. It's not kind of unexpected or anything. You set up a certain situation for certain considerations that you feel good at that time, and then later it's a little difficult to change it. Now, when that law was actually established, the situation was one thing. And here we are, say, 80 years later, and the situation is another thing. In those days, there was not much communication between, say, the Theravada and the Mahayana. And these days, over the last, say, even 50 years, it's quite a long time now, there's been a lot of communication between those groups. Basically, I think if you'd have asked a Theravada monk what he knows about Mahayana 80 years ago, you know, he wouldn't have known anything. You know, he wouldn't know anything about it at all. So the prospects of being able to bring back the Bhikshuni order through the Mahayana was not even on the table. It was not even in consideration. And as the Bhikshuni order had died out in the Theravada, it must have appeared there's no way for it to be re-established. At that time, it's not an unreasonable thought to have had. Now, however, the whole ball game has changed completely. You know, in the universities, that means even the monastic universities, the big subject is comparative studies. You know, I can tell you, I lived in a university in Sri Lanka for a number of years, and one of the main theses they take is either explaining Mahayana scriptures or comparing Mahayana scriptures and Theravada scriptures. See, another part of it is the opening up of the scriptures to the general public, if you like, through translations. That's only taken place recently as well. But once they're into translations, then groups that are outside that group can start studying about that group, and they can start understanding, you know, what the actual position is. You see, until recently, I think most Theravada monks do not know that the Tripitaka that we receive is basically preserved in the Chinese, in Chinese translation. Most Theravada monks, some time ago, you know, say 20 years ago, would not know that. They would have felt like that the only recension of the original teachings was preserved in Pali. But in actual fact, there's recensions, like a broken recension in Sanskrit. There's an almost complete recension in Chinese and also in Tibetan. You know, those teachings come from the very earliest times. And in most of those teachings, there's nothing that, you know, like a Theravadan, Sri Lankan or a Thai or a Burmese would object to. They're actually the same teachings. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is the amount of historical studies that have gone on and have brought to light all these sorts of things about how the Bhikshuni order was taken to China and, you know, later given back and so on. This was not known in 1930. But now we are living in a different world, you see. We know all of these things, not all of them actually, but we know quite, you know, it's sufficient enough about these issues to know that the sanghas all come from the same source. They contain the same, they have as their original basis the same scriptures and so on. And so the whole ball game has changed. As the conditions have changed, now we must change how we relate to each other. Driving factor. Yeah, actually, probably, because I think this is true. I always try to, to try to see the other side of it. What they were trying to do is protect the sasana. It may not be what I would think is protecting the sasana, but I think their intention is such. You know, they don't believe that there can be bhikshunis. And they think that if somebody takes on that role, then it's actually going against what can be done. So I think from their point of view, and I think also with the hierarchies that we see today, who are opposed to the reintroduction of the Bhikshuni order, I don't think we should attribute ill will to them. It's simply that they see it in a different way. Yeah, so we should have some understanding. They come from a different generation, mainly. They've been brought up with different background. Their knowledge about other traditions may be quite limited. In fact, I'm sure it's quite limited. You know, their contact with other groups is very limited. You know, so it's not a matter of blaming anybody. I really don't like that. It's not that we should blame anybody. We can understand what their position is, and still we can try to, you know, get back to the original situation, which is what the Buddha intended. Okay, so everybody came along tonight. It's a long night, actually, and takes quite some effort and everything to come along. It's really a meritorious thing to come and understand a little bit more about the Dhamma, understand about the situation, the history of the development of the sasana and so on. Everybody come with goodwill, and so that's very meritorious. So now we'll also do another very meritorious thing, which is to pass the merits to our departed loved ones. That means both relatives and friends. So you repeat after me. Idam me nyatinam hotu. Sukhita hantu nyatiyo. Idam me nyatinam hotu. Sukhita hantu nyatiyo. Idam me nyatinam hotu. Sukhita hantu nyatiyo. Yatavari vahapura paripurenti sagaran. Eva meva itodinan petanan upakapati. Annamē udakān vatān yatā ninnān pavattati. Evamēva itodinnān petānān upakappati.